Why are we here? I'm not going to wait for an answer. For that question is a little bit confusing. It could be like an existential question. What is the meaning of our lives? Why are we here? Or it could just be asking more simply, why do we gather like this on Sunday mornings? Why do we belong or participate in the Universalist Unitarian Church of Halifax? The poet W.H. Auden famously said, "We are here on earth to help others. What the others are here for, I have no idea." See, Auden seemed to be saying that he recognized the promises that he makes to other people, but he didn't see the flip side, the promises that other people make to him. At times, we see ourselves as the most important things in the universe, rather than seeing ourselves as part of the web of all existence. And it's in that web that we find a rebuttal to Auden's statement. So this morning I'll be borrowing heavily from the magazine that we published for the month of September on the topic of promise. I hope you had a chance to peruse it. I mentioned the one for Grace is out now, and we'll be distributing it on the web, so you get an electronic copy. But the magazine is full of material that's been contributed by over 100 ministers and members of congregations that are working together on this theme church project. So it's an excellent source for a minister to draw from. The concept of making a promise is arguably the most fundamental claim of our faith, of Unitarian Universalism. UU's don't focus on beliefs or creeds or dogmas. We focus actually on the act of making and keeping our commitments. If the kingdom of God is to come, it will not be when we all think alike. It will be when we follow through on our commitments to love our neighbors as ourselves. Henry Nelson Wyman, a Unitarian and a process theologian, wrote of religion and faith as being not ultimate concern, but ultimate commitment. Inevitably, in our lives, we commit ourselves to something. You've heard me say before that we all have faith. It's just a matter of what we have faith in. For many of us, it's faith in the almighty dollar. So, inevitably in our lives, we commit ourselves to something, whether it's worthy or not. The direction and intensity of our faith and our loyalties give shape and meaning to our lives. Loyalties, commitments, covenants, the promises we make to one another, these are the things that relate to the deepest meaning, to our deepest meaning, a meaning that we choose for our lives. They tell us what we belong to, and by doing so, they tell us who we are and what our lives mean. So one of the answers to the question that I posed earlier is that what we are doing here, and by that I mean this morning, this gathering, this Sunday service, is that we are honoring a promise. We're here honoring a commitment that we've made to one another. We recognize at some level that our presence here is a blessing to everyone else who has come here this morning. Fact is, we have made a promise or a commitment to be part of a religious community that comes together in this way, and that cannot exist without that commitment and that promise. Of course, the Sunday service isn't the only way that we come together. It may not even be the most important way that we come together. But this promise, this commitment, includes a commitment to diversity. We recognize that we are all individuals with our own perspectives on life. I love the story of the Sufi judge. Sufism, according to its adherents, is a mystical branch of Islam. So a Sufi judge was adjudicating a very difficult case, and he listened carefully while the plaintiff made his arguments. And he spontaneously shouted out, "You're right. You're right." But you can imagine that kind of upset the defendant. He hadn't even made his case yet. went ahead and pressed on, and he made his case, counter to what the plaintiff was making. And the judge responded, "You're right, you're right." The crowd, the assembled people in the courtroom were obviously getting upset, and one of them stood up and said, "Your Honor, Judge, both of these people cannot be right." And the judge responded, "You're right." We don't expect everyone to agree with us. And we made a commitment, a promise, to respect one another and to learn from one another, regardless of our personal beliefs and our personal ideologies. We not only tolerate diversity, we love diversity. In the way that love calls us to extend ourselves for our own spiritual growth and that of those within the congregation. We strive to cherish that fact, that others look at the world differently than we do. In an article by Reverend Rebecca Parker called "We're Already in Paradise," she points out different ways of seeing the ultimate destiny in a Judeo-Christian context. She rejects visions that paint our existence here in this world as something that's to be endured while we work towards a better world, or while we wait for a better world to emerge, supernaturally or otherwise. She argues that the social gospel movement, which called on each person to work towards a better world, has lost its appeal because in focusing on the problems of the world, the movement has failed to find a source to recharge the energy that such work demands. The thesis of her article is that we are already living in paradise. And the knowledge of our true location in paradise can be that energizing and sustaining force that we need to do the work to protect and preserve Eden. She calls this radically realized eschatology. I quote, "Radically realized eschatology offers a third way, one that holds promise especially for those who have found idealistic belief in progress too fragile a foundation for sustaining social activism. It begins with affirming that we are already standing on holy ground. This earth, and none other, is the garden of beauty, the place of life. Neglecting it or rejecting it for some other imagined better place will be a self-fulfilling prophecy. It will make earth a wasteland. There is no other land promised to any of us other than the land already given, the world already here." Elsewhere in the article, she writes, "We come to know this. We come to know this world as a paradise when our hearts and our souls are reborn through the arduous and tender task of living rightly with one another on the earth. Generosity and mutual care are the pathways into knowing that paradise is here and now. This way of living is not utopian. It does not spring from the imagination of a better world, but from a profound embrace of this world. It brings hope home today, to this moment, and its possibilities for faithful love. If we shift our gaze from what we want to what we have, suddenly our life is generous rather than a threat." For some, I know this is going to sound Pollyannish, wildly optimistic. I will admit that I resonate with this view of the world. And as your minister, I confess that I need help from time to time to see the world maybe in a more realistic, maybe in a more critical way. For although I identify with Reverend Rebecca Parker's vision of radically realized eschatology, I know that others might struggle with it. For some, it is a depressing, even frightening thought that the world is the only thing that we can ever hope for. In a moment, I want to talk about the promises we make to one another when we become members of this congregation. In that regard, we cannot promise to modify our personalities, nor should we want to. We can promise to modify our behavior, how we respond to adversity. Behavior is negotiable, personality is not. And so I confess to you that my optimism, what some might consider a Pollyannish simplicity, is inborn, perhaps even a personality defect. So I want to digress here to tell you a little story. I'm selling a sports car that I've had for years and years with the intention of fixing it up and tooling around town in the summertime. I've reached the point in my life where I'm going to let it go. And that's a whole other sermon, just letting things go as we age. So I turned the car and a whole box of papers that go along with it over to the new owner, wished him luck. And he came back a day later, knocked on the door, and said he was going through the papers and I found something you might want. And he had an envelope full of my old report cards. And he was honest enough to say that he had read them. And it included my report card from kindergarten. And I brought it with me here this morning. That's my signature, and it hasn't really changed all that much. It's incredible. And I recognize a lot of the names, and some of them I don't, but kids in the class that signed the report card from kindergarten. So, frankly, this represents an embarrassingly rosy picture of me at age 5. But I bring it up now not to boast, but to point out how our personalities are inborn and often consistent over a lifetime. It reads in part. I'm going to blush when I read that. Norman is a good little fellow. So joyful and radiantly happy. So I've been reflecting on that assessment. And I've decided it would make a wonderful epitaph. I'd be happy with that on my tombstone. Norman was a good little fellow. So joyful and so radiantly happy. Now I know I've been very fortunate in my life to be able to sustain that happiness. Rebecca Parker quotes the poet Matthew Arnold, who saw a different world. A world that seems, in his words, to lie before us like a land of dreams, with neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. If this is the way you see the world, as your minister, I want to be able to walk beside you. I want to be able to help and support you. But I know that I first need to learn to sit with you, to hear and to hold the despair that you may be feeling. But as I do so, I'll be drawing my own strength from Rebecca Parker's radically realized eschatology, knowing that there is hope for happiness even in the most dire of circumstances. Another story I want to share with you. Many of you know a member of this congregation, Nancy Minertzager. Some of you don't. I'm going to share something with you, and I have not asked Nancy's permission to do this because I woke up at 5 o'clock this morning and said, I got to put this in my sermon. And I know Nancy, and I'm going to be reading this sermon to her later in the week, or she'll be listening to it, hopefully, and I think she'd approve. So I'm told that Nancy was once one of the most vibrant and socially engaged and physically active people that you could imagine. But I have, but over the past 10 years, I've only known Nancy for 3 years, Over the past 10 years, this vibrant, socially engaged, and physically active person has been suffering with progressive, degenerative, and ultimately fatal disease. It has brought her to the point where she can now barely move. She can't focus her vision to read. She's unable to speak. She has great difficulty in swallowing. In the time that I've spent with Nancy, I've been amazed by her spirit and the way she has responded to her deteriorating condition. A few weeks ago, I was with her and I told her that I could understand if she was angry, if she was depressed, if she was sad, if she was fearful. Nancy couldn't speak, but she communicates with me by pointing to letters of the alphabet on a cardboard keyboard. And she laboriously spelled out her answer, and you have to have a lot of patience. Moves your finger very slowly, and you're not sure whether you got the letter right or not. Sometimes it's kind of like playing a game and working out a puzzle. You get these, so I write down a letter at a time. When she identifies it, I try to see if I can see where it's going. When you're doing this, it's kind of amazing to see the words appear one letter at a time. You watch the words forming slowly and you try to anticipate what she's about to say. So when I told her that I could understand if she was angry and depressed, sad, or fearful, she gradually spelled out, "I am none of those things." And then it's very difficult for her, but she managed a smile that I'll never forget. A joy like this in those circumstances doesn't come easy. It's partly the result of an inborn capacity, partly a result of our struggle with life, and it's the result of something that I can only call grace. We cannot always choose the circumstances of our lives, but with grace, we can choose our response. One of the things we all have to learn is to forgive ourselves. Our soul needs forgiveness. We cannot move forward if we're mired in the mistakes of the past. Those who cannot promise kindness and forgiveness to themselves are rarely able to extend kindness or forgiveness to others. As I reflect on my own experience as a member of a UU congregation, I look back over more than 30 years of continuous membership spanning three different congregations, both in the United States and in Canada. Many of you here have similar stories to tell. I think that those of us with such experience have something important to share. I have seen and continue to be nourished and educated and loved and supported and held in so many ways by so many different people who were and are members of my congregation. At the same time, though, others have come and gone from these very same congregations, often leaving in anger, in frustration, or in pain. Dietrich Bonhoeffer was a Lutheran pastor, a theologian, a Nazi dissident, ultimately executed by the Nazis just weeks before the end of the Second World War. He wrote powerfully about what it takes to live in a religious community, despite the frustrations and the disillusionments that come with all human organizations. He writes, "Only that fellowship which faces such disillusionment, with all its unhappy and its ugly aspects, begins to be what it should be in God's sight, begins to grasp in faith the promise that is given to it. The sooner this shock of disillusionment comes to an individual, to the community, the better it is for both." He calls the idealization of community a human wish dream that is a hindrance to a genuine community. that must be banished if genuine community is to survive. A commitment to building real religious community together is one of the significant meanings of church membership. How one reacts to the first disillusionment in a congregation and all the other disappointments that eventually follow, it's an indicator and a test of your commitment, of your promise. Adversity is an aspect of every process of growth. To paraphrase Bonhoeffer only slightly, those who love their dreams of community more than community itself become destroyers of the latter, even though their personal intention may be ever so honest, earnest, and sacrificial. I'd like to repeat that. Those who love their dreams of community more than the reality of community become destroyers of the latter, even though their personal intentions may be ever so honest, ever so earnest, ever so sacrificial. I'll close now, knowing that you won't all agree with me, and knowing as well that you won't decide to leave this religious community just because you disagree with me. At least that's my sincere hope. As members of this congregation, we've made a promise to one another to live in covenant. Covenant is not intended to solve problems or to prevent problems. It is intended to hold us together so that we can resolve problems. There is no running away. And no matter how frustrated, angry, hurt, or despairing you might feel. And because you can't run away, you grow. Our poetic covenant has been included as an insert in the order of service. And I invite you now to read it together aloud with me. Our covenant reads together. Compassion is the doctrine of our church. The quest for truth is sacrament, and justice is prayer. To grow in understanding through dialogue and freedom. To support each other's dance with life. To engage the earth in peace. To the end that we seek ourselves into community and hear each other into being. Thus do we covenant with each other and with the universe. May it be so. Amen.